Hi, I'm Robert Osborne, and thanks so much for joining me for TCM's Private Screenings Uncut. It's a chance for you to enjoy complete conversations from our TCM archives with guests who've appeared with me on our private screening shows. You know, when we do our private screenings interviews, I usually sit with guests and talk for at least a couple of hours, but out of that, only an hour or less ever makes it to the air. So Private Screenings Uncut is a chance for you to hear the whole conversation. Now, this episode that you've picked is devoted to the very talented Leslie Caron. And I must say that of the more than 25 Private Screenings interviews we've done, I really have to rank this one as one of my favorites. Like many people, I fell in love with Leslie Caron the minute I saw her in her very first film, An American in Paris. But my interest and appreciation for her only grew with such films as Lily, Fanny, Gigi, of course, The L-Shaped Room, and even more so during the 2 hours that I did spend with her doing this interview. We did it in July of 1998, and it premiered on TCM in April of 1999, a year before Leslie joined Johnny Depp, Juliette Binoche, and Alfred Molina in the romantic comedy Chocolat. In this first part of the interview, Leslie talks about her complicated childhood, growing up in Nazi-occupied France. She also goes into great detail about the film that made her an overnight star, An American in Paris, revealing a number of stories which weren't included in the final version of our show. But you can hear it all now. Here's part one of TCM's Private Screenings Uncut, Leslie Caron. Leslie, is there one word more than any other that you would use to describe your life so far?
I think I would say diversity. For a long time, I felt I'd had about three lives. I had a life of a ballet dancer on the stage, then a life in Hollywood as a movie star, and then a return to Europe with writing, and then a fourth life with being a restaurateur now. So I seem to be trying a lot of different things just so I'm sure not to miss anything in life.
Is there one word more than any other you would describe Hollywood, your life in Hollywood?
Work. Work, work, work. It was extremely regimented. You were taught to be there at a certain time. Everything was written in as you came through the gates, and you were sent to makeup, you were sent to hair, you were sent to rehearsal, you were sent to shooting, you were sent to different departments, and every season of the year you had to do the photographs for the publicity, and it was extremely well put together and organized.
A great factory.
I was trying not to say that word, but yes.
To understand you, we have to go back a little, though, before Hollywood, to your life in France. And you grew up there during the war.
Yes.
And that must have had an enormous effect on your whole life.
Yes. Yes, it did. For years and years and years, I kept, when I had a nightmare, and it seems I had many, it was always a German soldier in boots with the back of the neck shaved, and the smell of the boots I could remember.
Really?
Forever. Yeah, it was a certain grease made out of not whale grease, but some kind of fish grease, and it was terrifying for a child to live among people with guns.
Was there a certain amount of terror all the time permeating the city at that time? It's hard for us to visualize that here.
A moment of what?
Terror all the time? Was there a certain amount of fear all the time in the air?
Yeah. You were in the subway, in the streets, in cafes, wherever you went, there were German soldiers with guns or machine guns. And you had to watch many things. For instance, to this day, I cannot stay in front of a dark window at night, knowing my back is lit, and I have no protection in my back. I always, if I'm back to a black window and the room is lit, I always close the curtains, because it's an automatic self-defense thing.
What about rationing and doing without? Was that a big part of your life?
Well, there used to be a great deal of humor about that. I remember we called it a une tartine, you know, bread, and then you would put butter, and then you would take the butter out, and you would call that a war tartine. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't anything to eat, frankly. They were animal fodder, and even potatoes were quite difficult to get. Meat was so scarce. And finally, the bread. Actually, during the war, they simply made black bread. They didn't make white bread anymore, and that was very healthy. But at the end, it was full of wood shavings.
Wow.
So, I don't know. It may be very good for the intestines, but...
Did it?
And even then, we had very little of it. I remember we had something like 2 slices a day. And for a child, that's very little.
Did it affect your health?
Yes, very badly. I had serious anemia when I came to Hollywood, and I caught mononucleosis as soon as I started filming. And doing an American in Paris with mononucleosis was terrible, terrible.
I'm going to get into that into a minute. But when did the ballet start? When did the dancing start in your life, and why?
Well, my mother had been a ballet dancer, and she always talked of Pavlova and Nijinsky and Diaghilev. And I started dreaming about that, and I had a natural interest in physical achievements. I took to swimming before walking, practically, and I loved playing on the beach with bars and doing all sorts of things. It just amused me. I was naturally gifted physically. So I was very eager to start ballet, and I'm the one who insisted. And I was told that at the age of, I can't remember, I think it was at the age of 12 or 14, I announced to my grandparents, who were very proper bourgeois, that I was going to be a ballet dancer, a professional one. And I can still hear my grandfather screaming, "Margaret, you want your daughter to be a whore?" Because it just wasn't done.
Even though she'd been a dancer herself.
Well, she suffered from a sort of, slight negative attitude of the family towards her because she had been on the stage. It was only recently, you know, that going on the stage was okay for young ladies of a certain breeding. Before that, and especially ballet dancers, were just girls from very, very modest backgrounds.
Really had no idea about that?
You had no idea
about
that?
No. I always thought the ballet was sort of on a level above everything
else.
Gosh,
no. No. Mm. Ballet was. I went for years in because I was raised in convents and Catholic schools, and for years I never said that I was taking ballet classes.
Mm.
Although taking ballet classes was all right for your allure and for your ease, but becoming a professional ballet dancer was simply not done. And I remember for years feeling very guilty about that, sort of an outcast.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, you must have taken to it very well, because if you announced that when you were 13 or 14 to the family, and wasn't it by 15 that you were...
16. 16? I was hired in the ballet company. But at 14 already, I was on the stage in children's theater and adored it. My mother had made me a dress out of an old costume of hers, and it was gray satin, and I came in on my tippy toes holding this up, and I remember the children going, "Oh!" It was the dress more than anything, but I enjoyed. I was dancing and acting, and it was twice a week, Thursday afternoons and Sunday afternoons. But I became a professional, full-fledged professional, with Roland Petit's company when I was 16.
Which was a great turning point, because wasn't it at one of those performances, the opening night, that Gene Kelly first saw you?
Yes, yes.
And he came backstage, as I believe, to meet you, but you weren't there. You had left.
Yeah, well, you know, I was still very much a young girl, a schoolgirl, and my job was done, and I didn't like all that backstage stuff, so I had just gone home. I lived very close by. I walked home. As soon as I'd finished my, you know, I scrubbed my face and went home.
You mean backstage stuff, like people coming back and complimenting and all of that?
I saw it happen to the star and to Roland Petit himself, and more famous people than myself. Jean Babilet, my partner, was a very famous dancer. He was as famous as Baryshnikov or Nureyev. And I just didn't think that was for me. I wasn't inclined to that sort of thing, so I just went home.
Did you like ballet, the people in the ballet,
and
that life?
The life was wonderful because we used to travel. Our home theater was Le Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, which is a very beautiful building. And we had, I think, one or sometimes two seasons a year there, 1 month each. And the rest of the time we were touring. And my first tour was to Egypt and Lebanon and Greece. And then we would go to the Edinburgh Festival, London, Switzerland, Italy. I mean, it was a dream life for a young girl, just very, very exciting. So everywhere we went, we were invited by the embassy, the French embassy, and people would give parties for us. We never had enough money, so we used to stuff the food in our pockets like you see in films. And sometimes they couldn't pay us at all. I mean, there was no union in those days. And I remember giving my, I had a mother and father, so whenever we were paid, I often gave my pay away. And ballet was very little paid in those days. I don't know why. When you look at football, I mean, what's the difference between those athletes and ballet dancers? Ballet takes much longer to learn. It takes a good 10 years. But in those days, there was only a very small crowd of balletmen. And so you didn't make enough money. It was a very prestigious kind of art for the select few. Unlike orchestra concerts or even opera, opera singers were paid very much. Well, they didn't study any more than we did. Mm. But ballet was always
short lifespan too.
Shorter, just about the same as an opera singer,
Now, was there any interest in films on your part at that point?
None.
Now, you certainly captured Gene Kelly's eye. Did you capture the eye of other filmmakers?
Yes. After the premiere of this ballet, where I was dancing a sphinx to Jean Babilet's Oedipus, I was on the cover of all sorts of magazines and all the newspapers and Vogue magazine and so on, all took photos of me. I didn't know why. I didn't, you know, I took it all in my stride. And then movie makers all made tests with me. I was even sent to England by Rank to do a 3-day test. And the general consensus was, she looks like a little drowning cat. And no, she's just not the style of today. And so I was refused by everybody, thank God. But there was one American company that wanted me, and that was Hathaway, who was about to do a film called The Black Rose, and I think that's Fox. Mm-hmm. And Fox offered me the job and a seven-year contract. My mother read the script and said, "That's trash." And she said, "No, you won't do that." So I turned down my first.
The Black Rose with Tyrone Power.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was another French girl who did it.
Cécile Aubry, I believe.
Good for you. Yeah.
Now, in Hollywood, meanwhile, a couple of years have gone by, they're planning this film called American in Paris. And I believe one of the first ideas was to have Sid Charisse do it, who was under contract. But
yes.
Gene Kelly really wanted a French girl for
it.
Yeah. And remembered you. Now, there is a story that Gene Kelly is the one that first brought your name up. There's another story that Arthur Freed had seen you on the cover of Perry Match.
No.
It was Kelly?
It was Kelly. Kelly remembered me, and he came to Paris to do a test with another girl who had done ballet but was mostly a movie actress. And at the same token, at the same time, he sneaked in a test with me. And said to me, I remember, he said, you know, I could get fired for this because I'm not supposed to do a test with you. But he said, I know you can dance, but I don't know how you photograph and I don't know if you can act. So he did the test and I just forgot about it.
Do you remember what the test was? I mean, what did you do in
the
test?
Yeah, I did the scene on the love scene where he sings, Our Love Is Here to Stay. He didn't do the singing, but he did the text of that scene. I was monumentally embarrassed and shy.
Were you nervous?
Oh, nervous doesn't describe it. I was just dying. I wasn't used to expressing myself with words, you see. So, and I thought, I'll never do. I know nothing about modern dancing, and it's not my stuff. So I forgot about this, and I was preparing to do a concert for the club of my father's school, and suddenly there was a phone call. MGM wants you there in 3 days. You've been picked up. And then I quickly made this blouse that you see on the cover of Life magazine, and Match. And Match made... No, that wasn't quite the way it happened. When Gene came, somehow Match had just done this cover. And I had made the blouse. And I think the cover of Perry Match convinced the studios that I had something.
Do you remember your very first meeting with Gene Kelly? Where it was?
And yeah, it was at the George V Hotel. He had a suite there. And he opened the door and... very kindly, but oh God, I was shy. I was quite nervous.
Was he welcoming?
Oh, he was terribly nice and very tactful and very brotherly and very... and he remained so for the rest of his life. He was sort of on the lookout for me. And during the filming, he was funny. He used to say, honey, turn your face to the camera, otherwise your mother won't know you're in the film.
He must have been very proud of you. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Discovering you as he did with
yeah.
what you accomplished with your career.
But Gene had discovered quite a few people. You know, I think Gene was, I mean, the Arthur Freed group was a little nucleus, but Gene was very much forward as an inventor of how to photograph ballet, how to, what to dance numbers. I mean, he became a very important element at MGM and at the Arthur Freed unit. And Vincent Minnelli was the favorite director and the most important one. But he trusted Gene to be the creator when it came to dancing and to any kind of number. And then Gene would place the camera, and Gene was then the director.
Mm-hmm. Was it a major decision? It must have been to decide whether or not to leave ballet and go into this whole new field. Was that a, did you regret that decision ever?
Yeah.
Early
yeah,
on?
I did early on. I adored ballet, and as a matter of fact, it became so difficult and painful to keep up both professions, acting and dancing, that I felt I had to give up one or the other. I just couldn't keep up both together. Between films, I was taking so many classes. I had to learn English, I had to learn acting. I had to keep up my ballet. So I was studying all day long. And eventually, I really took to acting with great passion. And it's thanks to Jean's wife, Betsy Blair, who said, you know, you seem to show some inclination for acting, and perhaps you'd like to take acting classes with my teacher. And he was a Russian actor who had been taught at the Stanislavski School in Moscow just on the onset of the revolution, and had run away from Russia, gone to Germany, learned Russian, acted in Russian, in, what did I say, German films, then was escaped by the skin of his teeth, is that?
Absolutely.
And came to Paris just as the Nazis were about to arrest him, and from there went to England, acted in English, which he didn't know, and from there went to America and created a theater. His name is George Danoff, and he came to America with Michael, the Cherry Orchard by
Chekhov,
Michael Chekhov. So Chekhov and Zhdanov went together to America, created a school with and an acting company and a performing theater company, and became quite good. So good, the actors were so good that they were stolen by Hollywood, to the point where they said, well, it's no use continuing, let's go to Hollywood ourselves. And both did work in the movies and started teaching.
Was there any objection at MGM for you taking classes in the Stanislavski method?
Yeah. I had to keep very silent about that. The teacher was Lillian Byrne, and well, I suppose she taught the...
Famous Lillian Byrne.
Yeah, I guess she taught the old-fashioned, you know, sort of exterior acting, which was exactly the opposite of this Stanislavski school.
There was an MGM look to those ladies. I mean, they all kind of moved the same way, and it was all Lillian Byrne's.
I think her favorite pupil was June Allison, and she looked a bit like June, and June, they were great friends, and it just wasn't my idea of acting at all. She had different methods, like, you're listening, you know, and you're scared. It was all grimaces, very much like the, you know, sort of silent movie acting, very, very exterior. And I was learning the opposite. I was learning to underplay and to think, and just, if you think something, it'll show on your face. It's enough.
What was your first impression of Hollywood when you got there, having come from France and the war and...
Disappointment.
Really?
Yeah. I thought, where is the Tuileries Gardens? Where is the Luxembourg? Where are the monuments? Where is the Seine? I did love the beach, but I was not taken in by the facades, which were not in stone. I was used to this capital all built in stone and the beautiful bridges, and my playground was the royal gardens, Le Luxembourg and the Tuileries, with the water ponds where I used to play with my brother, little boats, you know. And so I thought, well, where is the center? Where are the churches and the so on? And Beverly Hills then was just a bunch of shacks. They've been more built up since, and it...
Now they're bigger shacks.
But I thought it was extremely artificial, unreal.
What about the people?
The people were too sweet. You know, Cinderella, when she gets to the palace, really suffers because nobody else has had the experience she's had. Nobody else had gone through the war, seen people hung from light posts, and seen people being shot, and seen death and crumbling houses, and been in. At night, the siren would ring, and we would have to go in the basement, in the cellars, and hear the bombs and so on. I mean, the experience of that, nobody there had ever had. And I just found myself very excluded from, very lonely, because there wasn't anyone I could talk to about. And the blackout, where you had to go in the street with a little lamp, there was no lights in the streets, and danger was everywhere. And in the subway, too, there was danger, and people became very mean during the war. That's one aspect of the war that nobody realizes, is that people become vicious and violent. I saw so many men beating women in the subway. I saw really ugly scenes of women peeing in the streets. And there's a degradation of human behavior when there's a war that you cannot, you have to experience it to know that. And when you enter a war and think, okay, it's the war, I'm old enough not to have to go to the front, the consequences for one or two generations are something you cannot imagine. And the thieving and the cheating in the queues, you're queuing with the snow, you don't have enough clothes on, and it's desperate to have the food, and women will take the place of a child because they can get, you know. And I remember once my mother making a terrible scene. She was queuing for whatever, maybe cheese or butter, and I was queuing for bread or something. And when she came back to my queue, I said, "Mother, this woman has passed in front of me, you know." She started yelling at this woman, said, "Aren't you ashamed of yourself doing that to a child? How can you, you know," and the woman. But that was the behavior during the war, and mostly seeing men beat women. So it's the memory of this, and mm-hmm. I couldn't share it with anybody in Hollywood. They would say, "Oh yeah, we suffered during the war. We only had one slice, one chocolate bar per week." And I thought, oh my God.
Was your mother with you in California?
Yeah, she came with me. She came and stayed about 3 months, and we were given something like $300, which was like 2 weeks of salary. And we were put into the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, and my mother had nothing to wear. Well, neither of us. I was wearing clothes I'd made up, and I was young, so I looked all right. But my mother bought herself a three-quarter coat because she didn't have the proper clothes. And we had dinner, and she realized that what with the room and the coat and the dinner, we had already spent half of what we had been given, which was 2 weeks' salary. So she said, at 6 a.m, she woke me up and said, "Okay, now we are leaving. I've discovered a little hotel in Culver City, and you and I are going to stay there." So we arrived at this hotel, and it was really run down, sort of traveling salesman, third class place with the carpets were all filthy and it smelled bad. And it was, you know, Culver City is pretty rough. It's way down the line. And we stayed there during the weekend, and finally she called Jean Kelly on Sunday morning, and Jean said, "There you are! Oh my God, everybody's been looking for you all over Hollywood. Where are you?" And Mother said, "Well, we're in Culver City in the Culver Hotel." And he said, "What? The Culver Hotel? Oh, but that's not proper. You can't go there. This is totally improper. You know, this is where all sorts of assignations took mm-hmm. place." And so we were taken out of there, and my mother said, "Well, listen, we can't live at the Beverly Wilshire. We don't earn enough money, so we have to stay in a very modest place." So we found a motel in Culver City behind the electrical works. You know, they have had an electrical plant, and that's where we lived, and that's where I entered through the workman's entrance.
To go to work?
Yeah. And what was the difference for me? I just didn't see that it mattered which way I came in. And I didn't have a car. I didn't buy a car or anything. First of all, I couldn't drive, but I waited until I had enough money. I was never somebody who wanted to appear more than I had, and certainly did not want to get into debts. So I waited to have enough money aside to buy a little car and to live in a better place. So my beginnings were rather humble. I mean, you know, you think, oh, she was the big star of an American in Paris, but it was quite harsh.
So then the work process began. So you started rehearsals first with the doing the story or doing the rehearsals for the dances?
No, we never rehearsed the story. We rehearsed the ballets. Jean created the ballets, and it took about 2 months, I would say. And I could only wear ballet shoes so many hours a day, and I could only rehearse so many hours a day, and I was quite anemic and not too strong, and the floors were, although the rehearsal room had wood, which is the proper thing for ballet, but all the same, around 3 o'clock, I'd say to Jean, well, Jean, I've done all the rehearsing I can do. Can I go home? And he'd say, oh no, honey, you've got to stay there until we have, you know, we have to punch out, we have to stay our 6 or 8 hours.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Even a star as big as Jean Kelly?
Yep.
Well, what about dancing? Because when you're in the ballet, you're not dancing
no,
8 hours
of course not.
A night, or even in a ballet, you're not dancing all the time.
No.
How do?
That's what I told him. I said, okay, I take the class. And there was a ballet teacher who was brought in. He was brought in later when we had the whole company doing the big ballet. Otherwise, I would do my bar myself. But doing the bar is quite strenuous. It takes more than half an hour of very hard exercises. Then I would rehearse for, I don't know, 3 hours, and I was the only one doing the numbers. Then it was lunchtime. Then I would have to do a new bar and rehearse some more. And by 3 o'clock, I was done in. I was just exhausted. So your ankles swell and you just can't go on. But Jean said, put your feet up and let's pretend. And we stay there until it's time to go.
Amazing. Amazing. What about the floors when you said the rehearsal hall floors were wood.
Yeah.
Were they not wood on the sound stages?
No, and that was terrible on the legs.
I can imagine.
They were cement. And they painted them bright, glossy colors. And I said, I can't dance on that. I'm going to slip and break my neck. So they repainted for me with sand. And I said, I've got to put rosin on my toe shoes. And that was a very critical, difficult adjustment, because rosin leaves marks.
Mm-hmm.
And on a stage in the theater, the stage is not glossy, not shine, it's just washed. Nowadays, they put hard plastic things, which are not shiny and not slippery. But all the same, you do have to put rosin.
Right. Just painted would be like on glass, trying to dance
exactly,
on glass, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was one of the terrible things about dancing in films.
What about the acting, since you didn't have experience in that? Was that terrifying? And who helped you the most? Was it Minnelli or?
No, it was Jean.
Jean Kelly.
Yeah. Minnelli was always very shy. I had very little. I mean, Minnelli was an adorable presence, and I was very, very fond of him. I had a crush on him, and I thought, oh, this wonderful, sweet man. He used to call me Angel, and I wanted to please him, but Jean is the one who would give me the most advice. And Minelli was forever a very, very shy person. And he was incapable of explaining to you what he wanted. He would always start a sentence and, Angel, would you, you know, when you, well, what I mean is, do it again. I thought, okay, what does he want? And I'd try this and I'd try that. And Jean would be the sort of go-between and make me laugh and relax me. And but as far as I'm concerned, I made that film in a trance of shyness. And I can see, all I can see is just a shy girl.
When you see it now?
Yeah, trying to get off that silly smile that was sort of pinned on her face, and I didn't know how to get off the smile because I had so many teeth and that big mouth, and once I was caught in a smile, I didn't know how to get off it. I didn't know how to act.
It sure works. Did you see rushes as it was going along?
No.
Well, and in the meantime, I suppose there was this whole support system because publicity was going on. All that sort of thing coming at you for pictures and all of that. What about that? How did that affect
smiles, you? Smiles. Just, you know, they would be, the foreign press would come on the stage with reporters from Belgium or from Switzerland or from France or from Oregon or from New York, and queens would come and princesses would come and pictures. We always, that was very well set up. Dignitaries, there was a special person to take dignitaries around the movie studio, and they'd go from set to set and they would watch us film, and then we would have to take pictures with them.
Did you ever have a chance to go over to other sets and watch others working?
Oh yeah, in between.
Any vivid memories
sometimes
of that?
Yeah, I remember the big number of Esther Williams in that huge pool with all the sirens, and it was quite spectacular, and she plunged and she was so beautiful, and her makeup just stayed rosy and didn't move. And I remember later on I went to see Jean and Frank Sinatra on Singing in the Rain, and
Donald O'Connor?
Jean and Frank were doing a film later. And I can't remember what film that would be, On the Town?
Could be On the Town, yeah. Take Me Out to the Ball Game?
Yeah, On the Town, I think,
Were you getting any feedback at this time at the studio? I mean, you're a brand new girl, you'd never been photographed before, you had a different look than anybody. Were you getting any feedback from MGM that it was going well, or they were pleased with the results?
No.
No confidence boosters along the way?
Well, yeah, Jean would keep me, Jean and, but I didn't believe them. Hmm. I was very, very unsure of myself, and I think I thought, oh, they're just being sweet. I was totally like a lost little puppy. I had no idea, and the camera was something terrifying to me. This engine made of metal, and everybody being so quiet around it. I was used to the feedback of the public. Mm-hmm. And when you are on the stage, you can hear what they're thinking. You know, you can hear rustle, you can hear breathing, you can hear slight, oh, you know, if you do something remarkable, or there would be applause during a performance if you did some very difficult steps. And there, this utter silence froze me. It took a film or two or three before I felt the camera was my friend, and the crew was were my friends. And until I felt contact with the crew and the camera. And later on, I also could feel the director, who was usually sitting right underneath the camera. And without looking at him, I could feel, you know, there was an umbilical cord,
mm-hmm.
and I could tell if he was pleased or not, even without looking at him. And I became very aware of the crew and their reaction. And then it became friendly. But the great big set, which smelt of the 10Ks, the carbons, and this slight dampness, and you know, the men up there on the walk, catwalks, were like ghosts. It was ghostly. And there you were, sort of little, very small little units playing with one person or two persons, and everybody going so quiet as you had to start. I wish it had been like an Italian set where mm-hmm. people keep on talking and carrying on with their lives as you're acting.
Mm-hmm.
That froze me to death at first.
You once summed it up, that period of making American in Paris, as a nightmare. Would you still describe it that way?
Well, I was sick physically, and I was very unsure of myself, didn't know acting, didn't know filming, didn't know English. So it was a lot of, when you have become, and I was this precious sort of, what's the word? Utility that had to be preserved. And I felt much more comfortable if I just was one of the guys or one of the... But I was so taken care of that you feel like the Dalai Lama, and it's very uncomfortable. The one person I really liked was an Indian body makeup lady. In ballet, everything, you know, you were wearing a very slight tutu or something, and she did all your hands, your arms, your neck, your ears, and your neck, and she draws a little line there so that it looks like you're fuller. But she was Indian, and she was very warm, and she had ethics, and she talked about her tribe, and I was very fond of her. I trusted her. She was my anchor. And then as soon as the film was over, my teacher became my anchor.
Mm-hmm.
He had this noble attitude towards acting as an art. Because otherwise, being an actress in Hollywood was like being a very sophisticated, you know, there was something illegitimate about you. You were like a kept lady or something, illegitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And he taught me a profession. And to me, the two anchors were that I was a professional dancer, and then I became a professional actress, and I knew my trade. So that was the way I withstood Hollywood. Otherwise, Hollywood was a place of just artificial showcase.
Mm-hmm.
And people were pretending to be suave, and you know, there was a pretense. Even when you said hello to someone, it wasn't, "Hi there, how are you? Did you sleep all right last night?" And, "Oh boy, I saw, you know, I had a bad dinner or had a bad dream." Or you couldn't be normal with people. Nobody was normal. Everybody was afraid of losing their job. And there was a sort of atmosphere of fear in the studio, which I hated.
Tell about cutting your hair when you showed up with the new hairstyle.
Well, that was another...
That's courageous.
I was just myself.
This was before the film started shooting.
Yeah, the night before. I already had cut my hair to come to Hollywood. It seems to be, in my life, something, a sort of bravado I do to show my independence and to show now I'm free. You can't cut your hair during a film because you've got to match. and you can't get sick, and you can't, bleach your hair or dye your hair darker. You can't change anything. And once I even had a contract that said you can't change your sex. That sort of goes without saying, but they had it in a contract. Anyway, I thought, those poor people, the hairdresser just doesn't understand what I mean. I wanted this new hairdo, which I'd seen in Paris in the streets, and which Zizi Jeanmaire was wearing, and this great model was wearing. And those were the two women who didn't have all the poodle mm-hmm. curls. And I thought, that's what I want, that new look. So I was trying to explain to the hairdressers during the test, and they, yes, honey, but. And I was, poodle. And I didn't like that. I wanted to be modern. So the night before, I said, I've got to show them. They don't understand. So I took the scissors and started cutting, and with a mirror, cutting. And I came out with exactly what I'm wearing today, and came very pleased with myself and totally innocent. Oh, my God. The executive makeup, Bill Tuttle and Sidney Gilaroff, and they called the director, who called the producer, who called the head of production, who called Dori Sherry, and they all came down, and I was brought out in front of the wall, and I was literally like in this Goya scene of all the men. I was in front of the firing squad, and they were all lined up like this, looking at me in total dismay and going, oh my God, what has she done? What can we do? And it was the first day of shooting I was supposed to. It was all set up. There was a set, and they had lit it. And of course, I was used to doing my own persona on the stage mm-hmm. and presenting myself the way I thought I should. I had a great deal of liberty there with Roland Petit. And Jean said to me, Leslie, you are absolutely mad. And if you'd known, they fire girls for less than that. So they had to shut down production. They had to, we went back to rehearsal for 2 weeks. They had to redesign a new set, paint it, and they started on a new scene. I had no idea it would
was that too
bring down the house like that. I just completely, broke up the system for 2 weeks.
During that 2 weeks, what were they trying to do? Figure out how to make your hair
grow,
they were
pulling
or
my
to
hair,
put a wig on or something?
And I had a spy next to me who was told never let a pair of scissors near Leslie. Pulling my hair and...
But they finally went with it, and it was a great look.
It wasn't what I meant.
Oh.
I meant straight, like this. I wanted to look
so
more
the hair,
boyish.
So the hair that you did end up with was still not what you were after?
No. But what can you do? They took the ironing tongues and waited until it grew a little bit, unfortunately. Because I would have been the first. I know it would have worked. It would have been... and then I was copied by the assistant, Carol Haney, Gene Kelly's assistant. Then she went on the stage. And
pajama
she
game.
Did Pyjama Game. And her understudy was... Shirley MacLaine, who cut her hair just the same. And then Jean Seberg did...
St. Joan?
No, she did... I suppose they cut her hair in St. Joan, but she did the French film.
Bonjour. Breathless.
A Bout de Souffle. Mm-hmm. And Breathless, and she cut her hair that way. It changed the look of women. But had they only let me do it the way I wanted, I would have been right. I knew it was in the wind.
You bring up spies. Was there a lot of spying and that sort of thing going on at MGM?
Yeah.
People reporting back to the head office? Is that what you mean?
I don't know. Everything was written down on a book. Everything. If you asked for 5 minutes to go to the bathroom, it was written in. And if you took 7 instead of 5, it was written in. Everything you did was written in the book. And you were taken aside by the first assistant who told you, listen, I know you prefer to walk, but you've got to take the car. A star doesn't walk to the commissary. So sometimes I'd say to the car driver, listen, come with me, but I prefer to walk. It keeps the blood running. So I know you've got to do the same trajectory, the same, but let me walk. And, you know, everything was like that, a little frightening. You felt everything was controlled, very controlled.
What are your memories of Oscar Levant?
Oh, Oscar was divine, was just a sweet, sweet man. Neurotic as they come. I mean, that scene where he's smoking 3 cigarettes was something he would do. And if you said the word death in front of him, he'd pass out or run out or... I remember on one Sunday we did a film, a little murder mystery at Gene Kelly's backyard, and all the girls were being murdered one way or another, and it was Comden and Green doing, and Gene, and we were all, you know, passing out, and I was drowned in a bucket, and I mean, it was all very funny and childish. But when Oscar came in and we told him the plot, he just ran away. And I, my God, the word death terrifies him like that. So he was just like in the film, you know. He played himself. He was dry humor and humor towards himself, and just wonderful, talented, but in pain. All day long, in pain. He was so uncomfortable about living. Somebody who never got used to living.
What about Arthur Freed? You mentioned Minnelli and Kelly. Was he very active on the set, and did he come down a lot and exercise control?
No. I think Arthur was very... he chose the right people and he let them do their job. And besides, he was monosyllabic. Arthur had 4 words only in his vocabulary. It was yep, nope, terrific, terrible. That was it. And Arthur showed his affection to you by taking you out to lunch. And he, in the commissary, and he had the best table against the wall so that he could see everybody who was arriving and he could keep track of everybody who was there. And he never sat in front of you, and no conversation was ever possible. And I was, I was always trying to tell him the latest thing about London or about... And he just couldn't keep up a conversation. So he'd move his chair facing the room, and he'd sort of keep an eye, barely an eye on you, and he would nod and go, yep, yep, yep. And then he was always on a diet, but never lost any weight. But
his genius then was putting the package together.
Okay, that's one thing everybody knows about him. But the thing people don't know about him, the sweet, tender, hidden part of him was that he was the foremost grower of orchids in all of America.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. He had an orchid orchard and was a tender gardener. And inside him was a very, very sweet person. And there's only once that he got mad at me and talked. And that's, I mean, I was with a new wave of people. I was for Marlon Brando and James Dean when he came on. And I thought that Clark Gable was really old hat. You know, it was the older generation, and I wasn't impressed. And one day I said something about, well, Clark Gable was sort of old-fashioned, and he blew up. He told me off. He said, how can you say such a thing? I mean, Clark Gable was the king and is the king, and he's just tried to come up to that. He's a fabulous star. He's a big, big, important actor and star. And I think he was right. But I turned down a film with Clark Gable. I'm ashamed to, I mean, I could beat myself for that. Even though he was older, I should have had enough wits. But when you're young, you're very arrogant and not too bright. I did admire Katharine Hepburn, who was of the older school, and I did admire Spencer Tracy. I thought Spencer Tracy taught the cinema a great law that we were taught in the Stanislavski school, and that was to listen. Spencer Tracy is almost better listening than talking. He knew how to listen. He really listened. And I think all the new actors took that from him. And look at Marlon Brando listening to his partner. He really has his eye glued on, and he's really reacting to whatever his partner is telling him. And that's something Spencer invented.
Do you have a favorite moment in An American in Paris? Your moment, a moment you have that you particularly like?
Oh, no. I remember the moment that I felt most uncomfortable in. That was when I had to say to Jean, Jerry, I love you. And he was about 30 meters away, and you know, I was terribly nervous about yelling on the set, I love you. To me, that was something you whispered, and that made me very uncomfortable. No, I can't. I didn't really enjoy making An American in Paris for those reasons. I was so new to all that.
Now, there was a slight censorship problem or something over one of your dance moments in the film, wasn't there?
Oh, that really was funny. Since the Hayes office had been opened up and controlled everything, there was a lady who I suppose came mostly on MGM sets. Maybe she went to all the studios, I don't know, but she ought to have been banished because her decolleté was much too low. But there she was, the censor, with the V down to our father, our son, you know. I mean, she really was décolleté. And she came and saw the number I was doing in a rehearsal. No, I had filmed it.
This was the introduction number where
I had done the dance number with a chair. And she saw it, and I mean, what can you do with a chair? But she thought that was really lewd. I mean, get her with that décolleté like this. And I had to do it again. I was too good. But I did another number like that in my career. Because I had this side of being demure and sweet and modest and very well brought up. But if you unleashed the sexy part of me, I could get up there with the best. And in Glory Alley, I did a number with on the bar with a sequence thing, very little on, and I was dancing with a chandelier and doing things that you don't usually do with a chandelier. And it's quite funny. I was singing St. Louis Blues, and I could have gone that way. I could have gone the sort of Marilyn Monroe way if I'd had if I hadn't had the education I had in convents and so on. But I could also do that kind of very overt, sexy thing.
But I think that was part of your appeal. We felt that underneath that exterior that existed.
This blazing.
Yes.
Sex kitten.
Were you surprised at the great reaction to An American in Paris? winning the Academy Award and being one of the landmark films. It was recently, of course, chosen one of the 100 greatest American films of all time.
Was it?
In the AFI.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
No. No. I was used to being with the best.
Hmm.
You know, when I was with Roland Petit, that was the best ballet company in Europe. And Jean Babillet was the best dancer in the world. And Gene Kelly was the best movie star, ballet dancers, I mean dancer. So, no, I thought that was quite as it should be.
Now, after the film was finished, it was like 3 months before you worked again.
Yeah, and I took classes, but I was very nervous about not, I wanted to act again. So I asked my agent and the studio, and so they put me into a straight acting film. The Man with the Cloak, with Barbara Stanwyck and Joe Cotton. And that was thrilling. I enjoyed playing with them and playing real acting.
Were they nice to you, a newcomer?
Oh, yeah, very, very nice. Joe Cotton was a very nice gentleman. And Barbara Stanwyck was a great pro and a very, very nice lady. I remember, I shall never forget how she stopped a shot and said, cut. And the director said, what? She said, I made a shadow on her. And that was really, nobody else has ever done that. I mean, sometimes at the end of a take, you will say, I couldn't. And once in a while, when I see a film, I see the actress getting too close to mm-hmm. the actor, and the actor backs away so as not to make a shadow, and she keeps coming, and you know, and she doesn't realize she's making a shadow on mm-hmm. herself. But it's very rare that any actress will interrupt or actor will interrupt a scene because of a technical thing like that.
Mm-hmm.
But she had her own mind. She was a very strong lady, and she was very disciplined. She was there at 5:30 in the morning, and she had a black maid who was with her all the time, and she knitted in between takes
mm.
and was always wearing those hand-knitted sweaters. But I have a very nice souvenir of her. She was very generous.
Then came Glory Alley, where you had a dramatic role, but it was
that's when
musical
I was so
again.
Sexy.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And Raoul Walsh, what are your memories of him
Raoul
as a director?
Raoul Walsh was fun. He didn't take it seriously at all. I don't think he liked the script, or it was a B movie. Although I suppose he liked B movies. He liked funky movies and
fast action movies.
Yeah, this wasn't an action movie, but it was in New Orleans, and I was playing this bad girl in a bar, and with Ralph Meeker, who was a brand new star and really adorable, very nice man. He was a pianist, you know, and he spent all his time not learning his lines or rehearsing, but playing the piano in the back of the set. And Raoul Walsh was being very careful of the one eye he had left. So he didn't much look at the acting. He'd be suddenly at the end of a scene, you'd hear, cut! And the voice came from over there, the coffee shop. And he'd walk slowly and say to the camera operator, was she in frame? Was he in frame? Everybody was in frame. Yeah, okay. And Liz, did they say all the lines? Yeah, they said all the lines. Okay, well, let's move on. And I'd say, well, how do you know we acted well? He said, I could hear. Or sometimes he'd say, oh, too slow, kids, too slow. Make it faster, come on. And most times he wasn't by the camera. He was over there drinking coffee or smoking a cigar or something.
So by this time you'd also embraced acting. This is now you're knowing
yeah.
that you really want to be an actress.
Oh, yeah.
And was the dancing becoming less important to you? Were you making decisions
at
this point about that?
Well, I made a decision by going to Jean Renoir, who had become a very close friend I used to go to the Renoir house very often, and I was, that was my French family, and Dido always sliced salami and gave you a glass of white wine, and Jean would talk, and I asked his advice one day. I said to him, I can't keep up those two careers, they're conflicting. Ballet wants you to be the best, always brilliant, always, you know, front row and so on. And when you're acting, sometimes you have to play broken down, or you have to play sad and so on, and not be the best. And I can't seem to manage to keep the two together. There's a conflict between those two personalities. And he said to me, well, I don't know if you're a great dancer, because I don't know anything about ballet, but I think you are an actress. And so he wrote a play for me.
Hmm.
And we went to Paris and did the play. So he,
really?
To teach me acting, yeah. To show me that I was, he was so generous that way. He had this really humane attitude towards his friends. And after the end of the play, on one of the last nights, Ingrid Bergman came in the theater. She came backstage and she was miserably dressed. She had the cheapest little gray coat, and she wasn't well groomed or anything. She had flat shoes, cheap shoes. And they went out to dinner. And the next day, Jean told me, you know, Leslie, I'm not going to make that film with you that we had planned. Because coming out of the restaurant, Ingrid sat down on the sidewalk and cried. And she said, my life is a mistake. I've broken my career. There's nothing in front of me except being a, you know, all the films she'd made with Rossellini were flops. Hollywood shunned her and was brutal with her. The press was brutal. And she saw no future for her. She was desperate. And so Renoir wrote a second play for her, and made the film, what's it called?
Elena,
et les hommes, and the men. And so that started Ingrid working again. But she was a wonderful, wonderful person. I was just entranced by her. I loved her voice, I loved her generosity, the bigger than life and sense of humor, and she enjoyed drinking, and she had friends, and she just was so full of life,
Lived it fully.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
Now, did you not, during that period, or maybe that was just before that, go back and dance again in Europe?
Yes, I went
during
back
your
with
MGM days.
Roland Petit. Mm-hmm. I was sick and tired of being such a good girl at MGM, and I wanted to fly away again on tour with Roland Petit. So before I gave up my toe shoes, I did that. I went on a tour and danced a sort of new version of The Sleeping Beauty.
Did that help make that decision for you? I mean, was that one of the deciding factors?
Yeah, that was my swan song in dancing, and I decided, well, I've got to concentrate on being an actress, and this is the last, and I enjoyed it enormously, but then I had to choose.